a year ago next week. Breckinridge held his ground until late afternoon, hoping to renew the attack as soon as the Arkansas arrived. When he learned that the ram was lying helpless 4 miles above town, he left a small force in observation and pulled the main body back to the Comeet River, from which he had marched the night before. The Federals did not follow. Aboard the grounded ram, the engineers were still at work with their files and chisels. Stevens got her afloat by throwing off some railroad iron lying loose on her deck, and by dusk the Black Gang had her engines back in operation. She started down the 4 mile reach, where the Union boats were standing guard, but had gone no more than 100 yards when the crank pin on the rocking shaft of the starboard engine snapped. A forge was set up on the gun deck, and one of the engineers, a former blacksmith, hammered out a new one. By the time it was finished, dawn was glimmering through, and the lookout spotted the Essex coming upstream, making a scant 2 knots against the current. Hurriedly, the new pin was installed. The rust-red Arkansas stood out for battle. Stevens intended to make a short run upstream, then turn and launch a ram attack with the added momentum. Before he could start back, however, the port engine suddenly quit and spun the vessel once more into bank. The Essex was coming slowly on, firing as she came, and the Arkansas was hard aground, able to bring only one of her guns to bear. The situation spoke for itself. Stevens ordered the crew ashore and fired the vessel, tears streaming down his face as he did so. When the flames reached the gun deck, the loaded guns began to explode, so that the Arkansas not only kept the Essex at a respectful distance during her death throes, but administered her own coup de grace and fired her own salute as she went down. Thus, she made a fitting end to her 23-day career. Brown almost got there in time to see it. Cured of his fever by the news that his ram had gone downriver without him, he got back onto the southbound train and rode to Ponchatoula, where he transferred to horseback and struck out westward for the river, in hope that he could hail the Arkansas from bank and somehow manage to board her, or at any rate be near enough to watch and cheer her as she fought. What he saw instead were exultant Union gunboats steaming back and forth across the muddy water where she had exploded and sunk with her colors flying. Sadly, though he was proud, he later wrote that her deck had never been pressed by the foot of an enemy. He rode back the way he had come and returned to Vicksburg. Breckinridge shared the pride but not the sadness at the outcome of the brief campaign. This reaction was based not on the casualty lists. Both sides had lost 84 killed, though the Confederate total of wounded and captured was larger, 372 to 299, but on his view of the fighting qualities shown. In one respect, the contrast between the opposing forces was very striking, he declared. The enemy were well clothed, and their encampments showed the presence of every comfort and even luxury. Our men had little transportation, indifferent food, and no shelter. Half of them had no coats, and hundreds were without either shoes or socks. Yet no troops ever behaved with greater gallantry and even reckless audacity. What can make this difference unless it be the sublime courage inspired by a just cause? Whether right made might or might made right, or indeed whether either was on the former vice president's side in this case, was a question open to much debate then and thereafter. Butler, for one, did not agree with his assessment. According to him, the rebels took advantage of the garrison's sickness from the malaria of the marshes of Vicksburg to make a cowardly attack, which was bloodily repulsed with more than 1,000 killed and wounded. But the Southerners' claim to physical as well as moral victory was considerably strengthened 2 weeks later when Butler, after congratulating his soldiers for their staunchness, "The Spanish conqueror of Mexico won imperishable renown by landing in that country and burning his transport ships to cut off all hope of retreat. You, more wise and economical, but with equal providence against retreat, sent yours home, ordered Baton Rouge abandoned, and dispatched those same transports upriver to bring the endangered troops back to New Orleans." The flow of what Horace Greeley back in May had been calling a deluge of victories was seemingly reversed, and there was corresponding elation in the South. Next to the capture of a northern capital, what could be better than the recovery of a southern one? More important, tactically speaking, the federal grip on the Mississippi, so close to strangulation a month ago, had been loosened even further, and to make sure that it was not reapplied, Breckinridge had already sent most of his troops to occupy and fortify Port Hudson, a left-bank position of great natural strength. Potentially another Vicksburg, its bluff commanded a sharp bend of the river about midway between Baton Rouge and the mouth of the Red, thus assuring a continuation of commerce with the Trans-Mississippi, including the grainlands of northwest Louisiana and the cattle-rich plains of Texas. That was but part of the brightening overall picture. In Virginia, McClellan had been repulsed. Grant was stalled in North Mississippi. Buell had lost the race for Chattanooga. And in all these widespread regions, Confederate armies were poised to take the offensive, particularly in East Tennessee, as Breckinridge learned from a letter Bragg sent him immediately after the fight at Baton Rouge. Extending an invitation to the former bluegrass politician, the terrible-tempered North Carolinian was in a strangely rollicking mood. "My army has promised to make me military governor of Ohio in 90 days, Seward's time for crushing the rebellion, "and as they cannot do that without passing your home, I have thought you would like to have an escort to visit your family." He added in a more serious vein, "Your influence in Kentucky would be equal to an extra division in my army. If you desire it and General Van Dorn will consent, you shall come at once. A command is ready for you, and I shall hope to see your eyes beam again at the command forward as they did at Shiloh, in the midst of our greatest success." This was seconded by Hardee, who telegraphed on August 23rd, 5 days before the Chattanooga jump-off, "Come here, if possible. I have a splendid division for you to lead into Kentucky." Breckinridge wired back, "Reserve the division for me." One prominent Kentuckian already commanded a division under Hardee, Simon Buckner. Exchanged at last, after 5 months in prison at Fort Warren, he reported in late July to Richmond, where he was promoted to Major General and assigned to duty with the army then on its way to Chattanooga. The army commander was glad to have him, not only because of his proved fighting qualities, but also as a recruiting attraction in his native state. Spare muskets were being taken along in wagons, ready for transfer to the shoulders of Kentucky volunteers. Bragg was glad, too, to have the approval of the president for the campaign he was about to undertake, though Davis warned him at the outset with a two-edged compliment predicting future strife, off as well as on the field of battle. "You have the misfortune of being regarded as my personal friend, and are pursued, therefore, with malignant censure by men regardless of truth, and whose want of principle to guide their conduct renders them incapable of conceiving that you are trusted because of your known fitness for command, and not because of friendly regard. Revolutions develop the high qualities of the good and the great, but they cannot change the nature of the vicious and the selfish." Kirby Smith, described in the same letter as "one of our ablest and purest officers, whose promotions like your own have come unsought," left Knoxville on August 14th to move against his West Point classmate, George Morgan, at Cumberland Gap. The two brigades received from Bragg had raised his striking force to 21,000 men, well over twice the number holding the gap. But finding, as he had predicted, that Morgan was better prepared to resist a siege than he himself was prepared to maintain one, he left a 9,000-man division in front of the mountain stronghold, as Bragg had advised, and with the rest of his army crossed the Cumberlands 30 miles to the southwest at Big Creek Gap. "This was no raid," he told Richmond. "My advance is made in the hope of permanently occupying Kentucky. It is a bold move, offering brilliant results, but will be accomplished only with hard fighting and must be sustained by constant reinforcements." He marched fast, swinging north for Barberville, which he occupied on August 18th, The constant reinforcements, of course, would have to be in the form of local volunteers, but none were forthcoming here. 6 days later, while preparing to resume the march, he notified Bragg, "Thus far, the people are universally hostile to our cause. This sentiment extends through the mountain region of eastern Kentucky. In the Bluegrass region, I have better expectations and shall soon test their loyalty." Bragg's own estimate was rosier and a good deal more specific. "Everything is ripe for success," he informed his co-commander. "The country is aroused and expecting us. Buell's forces are much scattered and, from all accounts, much demoralized. By rapid movements and vigorous blows, we may beat him in detail, or by gaining his rear, very much increase his demoralization and break him up." On August 27th, the day before the jump-off, he sent word to Sterling Price, holding the line in North Mississippi, "We move from here immediately, later by some days than expected, but in time we hope for a successful campaign. Buell has certainly fallen back from the Memphis and Charleston Railroad, and will probably not make a stand this side of Nashville, if there. He is now fortifying that place. General Smith, reinforced by 2 brigades from this army, has turned Cumberland Gap and is now marching on Lexington, Kentucky. We shall thus have Buell pretty well disposed of. Sherman and Rosecrans we leave to you and Van Dorn, satisfied that you can dispose of them, and we shall confidently expect to meet you on the Ohio and there open the way to Missouri." Unquestionably, even without the inclusion of Missouri, which was scarcely more than a closing flourish for the benefit of Price, this was an ambitious project, but Bragg was not only ready and willing to undertake its execution, he had already selected a guide, a model. Beauregard and McClellan, along with a cluster of lesser lights, might take Napoleon. Not Bragg. His chosen prototype was a contemporary, a man who, in fact, was 7 years his junior. Back in Tupelo, on the occasion of promising his soldiers to give your banners to the breeze, he also told them, "Others of your countrymen, under the lead of Jackson and Ewell in the Valley of Virginia, have recently shed imperishable renown on our arms and shown what a small, obedient, disciplined volunteer army can do." What he intended now, as he stood poised for the jump-off, was a valley campaign on a much larger scale, with Smith as Ewell and himself as Stonewall. Like him, he could expect to be badly outnumbered strategically. He had fewer than 30,000 of all arms. Yet, like him, too, he would translate this disadvantage into imperishable renown by means of rapid movements and vigorous blows. So far, it was true, the only attributes original and copy had in common were dyspepsia and a readiness to stand deserters before a firing squad. However, it was Bragg's intention to extend these similarities into other fields of reaction and endeavor during the trial that lay ahead. Some measure of this intention, complete with Old Testament overtones, was communicated to his troops in a general order read to them before they left their camps around Chattanooga. "The enemy is before us, devastating our fair country, imprisoning our old and venerated men, even the ministers of God, insulting our women and desecrating our altars. It is our proud lot to be assigned the duty of punishing and driving forth these deluded men, led by desperate adventurers and goaded on by abolition demagogues and demons. Let us but deserve success, and an offended deity will certainly assure it. Should we be opposed, we must fight at any odds and conquer at any sacrifice. Should the foe retire, we must follow him rapidly to his own territory and make him taste the bitters of invasion. Soldiers, the enemy is before you and your banners are free. It is for you to decide whether our brothers and sisters of Tennessee and Kentucky shall remain bondmen and bondwomen of the abolition tyrant, or be restored to the freedom inherited from their fathers." Having heard him out, the long files shouldered their muskets and headed north. 4. In Virginia, though the basis for it was obviously a good deal less substantial, westward the Blue Glacier had not only ground to a halt, it had even reversed direction, whereas here in the east no more than a pause, a hesitation of the mass had seemingly been affected. McClellan, after all, was scarcely a dozen miles farther from Richmond than he had been on the eve of the 7 days, besides being more securely based on the James than he had been while crouched astride the treacherous Chickahominy, and Pope was hovering northward, a considerably graver threat, both in numbers and position, than McDowell had ever been. The elation mounted higher. One reason was that the result, however far it fell short of expectation, had been obtained by actual fighting, not by maneuver or mere federal acquiescence. Another was the return of confidence in the government, especially in the president, whose vindication now appeared complete. Less than a week before the launching of the assault that flung the bluecoats back from the Capitol gates, Tom Cobb had been declaring that he saw in Davis the embodiment and concentration of cowardly littleness, which he garnishes over with pharisaical hypocrisy. How can God smile upon us while we have such a man to lead us? Few were asking that question now. God had smiled upon them, and a large part of the credit went to the man who, by deed as well as title, filled the position of commander-in-chief and triumphed over the adversary who occupied that post in the country to the north. The Hezekiah Sennacherib analogy still held. As far as the soldiers themselves were concerned, however, the credit went to the general who had been placed at their head in their darkest hour, and in one short month, despite their initial resentment, had welded their four disparate components, Johnston's Manassas Army and Magruder's frazzled Yorktown Brigades, Jackson's Valley Command and Huger's unblooded Norfolk Division, into a single striking force, the Army of Northern Virginia, which he hurled with cunning and fury at the blue invaders, massed in their thousands within sight and hearing of Richmond's steeples and public clocks, and sent them reeling backwards or sidling crab-like to their present mud-flat sanctuary under the muzzles of their gunboats. Granny Lee, evacuating Lee, the King of Spades, had become for his troops what he would remain, Marse Robert. They watched him as he rode among them, the high-colored face above and behind the iron-gray beard, the active dark brown eyes, the broad forehead whose upper half showed unexpectedly dazzling white when he removed his wide-brimmed hat to acknowledge their cheers. Distrust had yielded to enthusiasm, which in turn was giving way to awe. On horseback, deep-chested and long-waisted, with his big leonine head set thick-necked on massive shoulders, he looked gigantic. Partly that was the aura. It must have been, for when he dismounted, as he often did, to rest his horse, he had a tender concern for the welfare of all animals, even combat infantrymen, aside from those times when he flung them into the crackling uproar of battle like chaff into a furnace. You saw the slight legs, the narrow hips, and realized with something of a shock that he was no larger than many of the men around him, and not as large as some. The same contrast, above and below, was apparent in his extremities. The hands were oversized and muscular, the feet tiny as a woman's. He was, in fact, just under 6 feet tall and weighed less than 170 pounds. Quickly, though, you got over the shock, which, after all, was only the result of comparing flesh and perfection. However he was how you preferred him. And when you saw him thus in the field, your inclination was to remove your hat, not to wave it, just to hold it, and stand there looking at him. Marse Robert. Not everyone offered such adulation, either in or out of the army. Robert Toombs, for one, who had commanded a brigade under Magruder throughout the Peninsula campaign, considered Lee far below the occasion. The Charleston Mercury, for another, while it praised the strategy, projected, as we hear by General Johnston, agreed with Toombs as to the tactics. The blundering manner in which McClellan has been allowed to get away, the desultory manner in which he has been pursued by divisions instead of our whole force, enabling him to repulse our attacks, to carry off his artillery, and finally to make a fresh stand with an army reinforced, are facts we fear not very flattering to the generalship of General Lee. Lee was rather inclined to agree with the former Georgia statesman as well as with the South Carolina editor, not only because of his inherent modesty, but also because he knew that what they said was largely true. His great victory did not elate him, so far as one could see, his cannoneer son later recalled. This was not for lack of material success. The booty had been ample, 52 fine Union guns, by coincidence one for every battery in the Army of the Potomac, 31,000 rifles, which gave some measure of the Federal panic since half were either dropped by casualties or handed over by captives, while the other half were abandoned by men who preferred to travel light, and 10,000 prisoners, most of them unwounded. All this was duly appreciated, especially the rifled guns and the badly needed small arms. But Lee's essential agreement with Toombs and the Mercury was based on a consideration of what had been left undone, as well as of what had been done, on the contrast, in fact, between conception and execution. Under ordinary circumstances, he said in his report to the Adjutant General, the Federal Army should have been destroyed. Sound strategy had largely counterbalanced woeful tactics to produce, within limits, a successful campaign. After all, Richmond was no longer even semi-beleaguered. But for the failure, so far as it was a failure beyond those limits, there were three main reasons. One, poor maps and intelligence, which left the Confederates groping blind or half-blind all the way from Mechanicsville to Harrison's Landing, inclusively. Two, poor staff work, especially in the transmission of orders, which was the basis for much of the lack of coordination. And three, the Army of the Potomac, the hardcore staunchness of its infantry, and the skill with which its superior artillery was employed. Of these, the last, referred to by one of Lee's own aides as the character and personality of the men behind the Federal guns, was clearly the most decisive in preventing the wreckage intended, but it was the first which caused what Harvey Hill summed up in one acid sentence. Throughout this campaign, we attacked just when and where the enemy wished us to attack. Time and effort, self-application on Lee's part, might correct the first two of these drawbacks. The third would be with him from here on out. Yet there was still another problem, one he would always face with reluctance, though it too would remain. This was the task of assessing the character and performance of his lieutenants. Longstreet and the Two Hills, whatever their personal eccentricities, whether headstrong or impetuous or caustic, had emerged from the test of combat with brighter laurels than before. The same could not be said of another trio, Magruder, Holmes, and Huger. Their reasons for failure were varied, overexcitability, deafness, chronic bad luck. But now that Lee had faced the problem, no matter with what reluctance, he was quick to act. He got rid of them. In Magruder's case, it was simple, for he had been offered and had accepted command of a department in the Trans-Mississippi. Lee wished him Godspeed along with Holmes, who went out there too, being placed in charge of the whole Far Western theater. That left Huger, but not for long. He was kicked upstairs to the War Department as Chief Inspector of Artillery and Ordnance. In the course of replacing these departed leaders and redistributing their 12 brigades, which meant in effect a drastic reorganization for the work that lay ahead, Lee dealt with another problem of command. The question of what to do about Jackson, whose poor showing throughout the 7 days was now the subject of much talk. He was reported to have said that he did not intend for his men to do all the fighting, and when he overheard some of his staff discussing his strange delay above White Oak Swamp, while Longstreet was struggling desperately at Glendale, he remarked coldly, "If General Lee had wanted me, he could have sent for me." Lee, of course, did not join the chorus of critics, nor did he consider shunting Stonewall off to the Trans-Mississippi. But in his regrouping of the Army's 9 divisions into 2 wings under its 2 ranking generals, Longstreet and Jackson, the former was assigned to 28 brigades, the latter 7. Stonewall thus had only half as many as had been under him during the late campaign, while old Pete had nearly five times as many as the half-dozen with which he had crossed the Chickahominy. All through this period of refitting and reorganization, of distributing the captured arms and replacing his veterans' flops, old shoes, and tattered jackets, Lee had also kept busy trying to determine the enemy's intentions. It was a complicated problem, involving no less than four federal armies of various strengths, all unknown. First, there was the main force under McClellan at Harrison's Landing. Then there was Pope's newly consolidated Army of Virginia, assumed to be in the vicinity of Manassas. Either or both might take the offensive at any time. The third was at Fredericksburg, threatening Richmond from the north, much as McDowell had done for months. The fourth was Burnside's, brought up from North Carolina in the emergency, but still kept aboard its transports, anchored mysteriously off Fort Monroe. Both of these last two forces were in positions from which they could move rapidly to combine and join either of the other two. Pope, for an advance against the vital Virginia Central Railroad, or McClellan, for a renewal of his drive on the capital itself. For the present, though both of course were possible, Lee could find out nothing that would indicate which was probable. All he knew for certain was that delay was not to the advantage of the South. Northern determination had stiffened after this defeat, just as it had done the year before, and Lincoln's call for 300,000 volunteers had gone out on the day of Malvern Hill. In chess terms, Lee's immediate problem was whether to keep his pieces where they were, concentrated to checkmate the king, McClellan, or to disperse them in order to meet an advance by the knights and bishops off on another quarter of the board. While awaiting developments, he withdrew his infantry from the malarial swamps and left the observation of Harrison's Landing to the cavalry, newly gathered into a two-brigade division under Stuart, who was promoted to Major General. Simultaneously, by way of discouraging an attack from that direction, he put his engineers to work constructing permanent fortifications. Anchored to the James at Drury's Bluff, and extending north along an arc shielding Richmond, these installations would also permit his present lines to be more thinly held if alternate pressure required dispersion. Once they were completed, he would be much better prepared for whatever came. What came, on July 12th, was startling news from the north. Pope had occupied Culpeper that morning. What made this startling was that Culpeper was on the Orange and Alexandria, less than 30 miles above Gordonsville, and Gordonsville was on the Virginia Central, at the northern apex of an exposed bend known as the Gordonsville Loop, which led on westward to Charlottesville and Stanton. This was alternate pressure indeed, for if Pope took Gordonsville, he would cut the Confederate supply line connecting Richmond and the Shenandoah Valley, where a bumper crop of corn and wheat was ripening for the harvest. Lee was obliged to meet this threat, and he did so the following day by sending Jackson with his own and Ewell's divisions, the old Army of the Valley, by rail to Louisa Courthouse, 15 miles this side of Gordonsville, which he was instructed to occupy if Pope had not already got there in too great strength to be dislodged. The movement was made rapidly by way of Hanover Junction, using 18 trains of 15 cars each to transport Stonewall's 10,000 infantry and artillery, while his cavalry and wagons moved by road. Strategically, this riposte was as sound as it was necessary, but Lee had other compelling reasons for ordering the movement, one being that he had developed a scathing contempt for the leader of the force at which it was aimed. After issuing the bombastic address to his soldiers, "Let us understand each other. Disaster and shame lurk in the rear," Pope had joined them in the field and had proceeded at once in a series of formal orders to give his attention to the civilians in his prospective theater of operations. One directed his army to live off the country and to reimburse only those persons who could prove devotion to the flag he represented. Another prescribed stern measures to be taken in retaliation for guerrilla activities. A third provided for the arrest of all male non-combatants within his lines, the expulsion of those who refused to take a loyalty oath, and their prosecution as spies if they returned. Furthermore, any man or woman who remained would be liable to the death penalty for attempting to communicate with the enemy, presumably including a mother who wrote to a son in the Southern Army. These mandates were not in accordance with Lee's notion of civilized warfare. He was downright contemptuous of the man who ordered their adoption. The miscreant Pope, he called him, and he said of him, he ought to be suppressed if possible. Just now, it was not possible, Jackson reported. He had beaten Pope to Gordonsville, arriving there from Louisa on July 19th, but the bluecoats around Culpeper were too numerous to be attacked at present. Reinforce him, Stonewall added, and he would gladly undertake all the suppression Lee could ask for. That was what Lee was considering, though the risk was admittedly great. Left with just under 70,000 men, including Holmes's former command, shifted south of the James to cover Petersburg and placed under D.H. Hill with an eye toward possible future operations in his native North Carolina, he knew he was badly outnumbered by McClellan, who, moreover, was beginning to show signs of activity. Besides, there were those other two armies, at Fredericksburg and off Fort Monroe. Lee still did not know in which direction they might move. Much as he wanted Pope whipped and driven back across the Rappahannock, the odds were long against weakening the capital defenses for that purpose. Nevertheless, he decided to take the gamble. On July 27th, he ordered A.P. Hill to Gordonsville, where the light division would join the Valley Army for a strike at Pope. His hope was that this combined force would deliver its blow quickly, disposing of Pope with a knockout punch, then return to Richmond in time to help block any assault McClellan might attempt when he learned of its detachment. This would call for rapid, well-coordinated movements, and a style of fighting characterized by a minimum of confusion and hesitation. Quite the opposite, in fact, of the style Jackson had demonstrated throughout the 7 days. One reason for his poor showing on the peninsula, Lee suspected, was his known reluctance to take subordinate commanders into his military confidence. Also, in consideration of Little Powell's sensitive and highly volatile nature, he had already clashed with Longstreet over what he considered a slight to his division in the distribution of honors, and Longstreet had promptly put him in arrest, from which Lee had released him for the present expedition. There was the danger of an explosion when he came into contact with the stern and taciturn Stonewall. Accordingly, Lee wrote Jackson a letter in which he alluded tactfully to the problem. After repeating the injunction, "I want Pope to be suppressed," he concluded, "A.P. Hill, you will, I think, find a good officer with whom you can consult, and by advising with your division commanders as to your movements, much trouble will be saved you in arranging details, as they can act more intelligently. Cache your troops as much as possible till you can strike your blow, and be prepared to return to me when done, if necessary. I will endeavor to keep General McClellan quiet till it is over, if rapidly executed." Keeping McClellan quiet might well turn out to be a good deal easier said than done. With one-third of his army off after Pope, Lee was down to 56,000 men, including two brigades that arrived next day from South Carolina. Whereas McClellan was not only half again larger now, he would have twice as many troops as Lee if he were reinforced by Burnside and the brigades at Fredericksburg, which Lee could do absolutely nothing to prevent. Besides, the young Napoleon had considerable freedom of action. He could stay where he was, a hovering threat. He could steam back up the Potomac to join Pope and the others. He could advance from his present camp against the southern capital, less than 20 airline miles away. In the latter case, two routes were available to him. He could move up the left bank of the James, more or less as before, except that he would be securely based, or he could cross the river under cover of his gunboats, capture Petersburg, and swarm into Richmond by the back door. All were possibilities to fret the mind of Lee, who who so far had been able to find no clue as to which course his adversary favored. "In the prospect before me," he wrote his wife, "I cannot see a single ray of pleasure during this war." One way to keep McClellan quiet, Lee reasoned paradoxically, or at any rate make him hug his camp while the Southern army was divided, might be to stir him up, that is, make him think he was about to be attacked. An infantry feint being impractical, Lee decided on an artillery demonstration. Under cover of darkness, 43 guns of various calibers were concentrated on the south side of the James at Coggins Point, opposite Harrison's Landing, and on the last night of July, they opened fire on the Federal camp. The result, as in the case of Stuart's pop gun bombardment 4 weeks back, was more spectacular than effective. After some original confusion, the Union artillerists and sailors brought their heavier guns to bear and smothered the Confederate batteries. On August 3rd, threatened with capture by an amphibious counter-movement, they had to be withdrawn. Except for the effect it might have had on McClellan himself, enlarging his natural caution, the demonstration was a failure. 2 days later, by way of recompense, Lee got his first real hint as to the Federal overall strategy. A young Confederate cavalry officer, Captain John S. Mosby, had been captured 2 weeks before while on his way upstate to find recruits for a partisan command, and had been taken to Fort Monroe to await exchange. As soon as he was released, he came to Lee with information he had picked up while imprisoned. Burnside was under orders to take his transports up the Potomac, debark his troops at Aquia Creek, and march them overland to Fredericksburg. If true, this meant considerable danger to Jackson, who was already badly outnumbered by the enemy north of Gordonsville, as well as to the Virginia Central, which led westward to the Valley Granary. What was more, it was a strong indication that the enemy's next major effort would be in northern Virginia, where Lee was weakest, not here on the James. He would have moved at least a portion of his force to meet this threat at once, except that on the same day his cavalry reported a heavy force advancing from Harrison's, up the left bank of the river, against Richmond. Apparently it was not McClellan's caution which had been enlarged by the abortive Coggins Point demonstration, but rather his self-confidence. Lee marched 3 divisions out to meet him the following day, August 6th, and approaching Malvern Hill near sundown found the Federals drawn up menacingly on the crest. Intending no repetition of last month's headlong blind attack up the rolling slope, he extended his left, skirmished briskly on the right, and braced his troops for the downhill assault. At nightfall, there was every indication that the armies would be locked in battle tomorrow. Instead, as had been more or less the case 5 weeks ago, dawn showed the hill empty of all but a handful of blue vedettes, who at the first sign of a Confederate advance scampered down the reverse slope to join the main body, already well on its way back to its camp on the James. This was strange indeed, passing strange. Lee decided that the only explanation for McClellan's sudden advance and retreat was that it was intended to cover the movement Mosby had discerned at Fort Monroe. If this was so, and Burnside was headed for Fredericksburg, there still remained the question of what he would do when he got there. He could join Pope directly, he could operate against Richmond from the north, or he could attempt to cut the Virginia Central in Jackson's rear, between Gordonsville and Hanover Junction. The best way to forestall this last, the most immediately dangerous of the three, would be for Jackson to strike Pope, who would then be likely to call on Burnside for support. Until Lee knew whether McClellan intended to renew his advance on Richmond, however, he did not feel that he could further weaken the capital defenses in order to reinforce Jackson. Nor did he feel that he should give him peremptory orders to attack, unsupported, without himself knowing the tactical situation at first hand. Accordingly, before the day was over, he did the next best thing. He sat down and wrote Stonewall a long letter in which he made it clear that he relied on his discretion. After warning him not to count on reinforcements, "If I can send them, I will. If I cannot, and you think it proper and advantageous, act without them," He outlined the dilemma as he saw it and suggested what he believed was the best solution, an immediate thrust at Pope, though he cautioned against rashness. "I would rather you should have easy fighting and heavy victories." It was a warning addressed more to the erstwhile hard-driving hero of the valley, who smote the enemy hip and thigh wherever found, than to the sluggard of the 7 days, who dawdled and withheld his hand from bloodshed. Apparently Lee had put the latter out of his mind. "I must now leave the matter to your reflection and good judgment," he concluded. "Make up your mind what is best to be done under all the circumstances which surround us, and let me hear the result at which you arrive. I will inform you if any change takes place here that bears on the subject." Mosby was right. Burnside had been ordered to Fredericksburg a week ago, on August 1st, 9 days after Halleck's arrival in Washington from the west. Having scattered the armies there for an assimilation of what had been won, Old Brains now proposed to unite those of the east for a new beginning. In both cases, however, since the concentration was not to be on the peninsula, where defeat was recent, but in northern Virginia, where defeat was a full year old, the effect was the same: to shift the Union juggernaut into reverse. McClellan, too, was about to be withdrawn. Nothing less than a new beginning would put the derailed engine back on the track. Or so it seemed to the newly appointed general-in-chief, who had reached the capital in a time of gloom. Flags drooped at half-mast under the press of heat, and crepe festooned the public buildings in observance of the death of Martin Van Buren, a used-up man. No such honors had marked the passing of the Virginian John Tyler the month before, but that was in a sunnier time, and even in the present instance the crepe seemed more an expression of the general mood than grief for a particular man, ex-president or not. Van Buren was already part of ancient history. Halleck, at any rate, wasted little time in speculation on such matters. Instead, after spending a day in Washington, he got aboard a steamer and went straight to what he believed was the source of discontent, the Army of the Potomac, camped now on the mudflats of the James. In spite of the pride he took in having executed the movement under pressure, and in spite of the fact that Lincoln had been congratulatory and Stanton even fawning, McClellan had been expecting trouble ever since his change of base. The president had wired him 1,000 thanks after Malvern Hill. "Be assured," he added, "the heroism and skill of yourself and officers and men is, and forever will be, appreciated. If you can hold your present position, at Harrison's, we shall hive the enemy yet." Stanton put it stronger, or anyhow longer. "Be assured," he wrote, "that you shall have the support of this department as cordially and faithfully as was ever rendered by man to man, and if we should ever live to see each other face to face, you will be satisfied that you have never had from me anything but the most confiding integrity." That was larding it pretty thick, but he larded it even thicker in conversation with McClellan's father-in-law, who went to Washington to see him. "General Marcy," he told the chief of staff with a sudden rush of feeling, "I have from the commencement of our acquaintance up to the present moment been General McClellan's warmest friend. I feel so kind toward him that I would get down on my knees to him if that would serve him. Yes, sir," he continued, warming as he spoke, "if it would do him any service, I would be willing to lay down naked in the gutter and allow him to stand upon my body for hours." Stanton lying naked in the gutter was a prospect McClellan could contemplate with pleasure, but he was not deluded into thinking such a scene would ever be staged, except in his mind's eye. He knew well enough that Stanton was working against him, tooth and nail, nor did Lincoln's assurances carry their former weight, especially after the arrival of John Pope and the administration's tacit approval of the mandates he issued regarding non-combatants in his theater of operations. That was what really tore it, McClellan wrote his wife. "When you contrast the policy I urged in my letter to the president with that of Congress and of Mr. Pope, you can readily agree with me that there can be little natural confidence between the government and myself. We are the antipodes of each other, and it is more than probable that they will take the earliest opportunity to relieve me from command and get me out of sight." Now here came Halleck, slack-fleshed and goggle-eyed, formerly his subordinate, now his chief, holding the office he himself had lost. It was bitter. Presently, however, after a hasty review of the troops, Halleck calmed McClellan's apprehensions by informing him that he had not come to undermine him or relieve him of command, but to find out what he required in the way of additional men in order to renew the drive on the rebel capital. McClellan brightened and unfolded a map on which he began to indicate, with pride and enthusiasm, a new plan of attack. He would cross the James and capture Petersburg, outflanking the enemy fortifications and severing the south side supply lines, then swing north and enter Richmond by the back door. Halleck shook his head. "Too risky," he said, and vetoed the proposal then and there. McClellan, his enthusiasm dampened, proceeded to an estimate of the situation. His effective strength, he said, was 88,665. Lee's was 200,000. Nevertheless, if the government would give him 30,000 reinforcements, he would assault the north side entrenchments with a good chance of success. Halleck frowned. No more than 20,000 were available, and if these would not suffice, he said, the army would have to be withdrawn from the peninsula to unite with Pope in the vicinity of Washington. Horrified at the notion, McClellan excused himself in order to confer with his corps commanders. Next morning he reported, somewhat gloomily, that he was willing to try it with that number. Halleck nodded and got back aboard the steamboat to return to Washington. McClellan's genial spirits rose again. "I think that Halleck will support me and give me the means to take Richmond," he wrote his wife. Whatever Halleck intended when he left, his final decision was considerably affected by a telegram he found waiting for him when he docked. It was from McClellan. Apparently it had been sent almost as soon as Halleck's steamer passed from sight. "Confederate reinforcements," he said, "were pouring into Richmond from the south. To meet this new development and to enable him to deliver a rapid and heavy blow, he wanted more troops than the 20,000 just agreed on. Can you not possibly draw 15,000 or 20,000 men from the west to reinforce me temporarily?" he pleaded. "They can return the moment we gain Richmond. Please give weight to this suggestion. I am sure it merits it." Halleck was amazed and went to Lincoln with the problem. Lincoln was not amazed at all. In fact, he found the telegram very much in character. "If by some magic he could reinforce McClellan with 100,000 troops today," he said, "Little Mac would be delighted and would promise to capture Richmond tomorrow. But when tomorrow came, he would report the enemy strength at 400,000 and announce that he could not advance until he got another 100,000 reinforcements." Halleck turned this over in his mind, together with another consideration. If Lee was as strong as McClellan said he was, stronger than Pope and McClellan combined, it was folly to keep the Federal armies exposed to destruction in detail. It was, in fact, imperative to unite them without delay. At last he made his decision, agreeing with Lincoln that McClellan's army would have to be withdrawn. On July 29th, he ordered every available steamer in Baltimore Harbor to proceed at once to the James. And next day he instructed McClellan to prepare to evacuate his sick and wounded. He did not tell him why. He merely remarked ambiguously that this was being done in order to enable you to move in any direction. 2 days later, Burnside was told to take his transports up the Potomac to Aquia Creek, where the troops would debark for a 12-mile march to Fredericksburg. McClellan's own orders were sent on August 3rd. "It is determined to withdraw your army from the peninsula to Aquia Creek. You will take immediate measures to effect this, covering the movement as best you can." McClellan was thunderstruck. The order for the removal of his sick had aroused his suspicions 5 days ago, despite, or perhaps because of, the disclaimer that it would leave him free to move in any direction, and he had been prompt to register his protest. "Our true policy is to reinforce this army by every available means and throw it again upon Richmond. Should it be determined to withdraw it, I shall look upon our cause as lost." Perhaps he thought the weight of this opinion would forestall any such calamity. If so, he now saw how useless it had been. Yet he did not abandon hope, or anyhow he did not stop trying to ward off the blow. At noon on August 4th, he knelt figuratively at the feet of Halleck and made a final anguished plea. "Your telegram of last evening is received. I must confess that it has caused me the greatest pain I ever experienced, for I am convinced that the order to withdraw this army to Aquia Creek will prove disastrous to our cause." First, he pointed out that it was tactical folly to make a march of 145 miles to reach a point now only 25 miles distant, and to deprive ourselves entirely of the powerful aid of the gunboats and water transportation. Add to this the certain demoralization of this army which would ensue, and these appear to me sufficient reasons to make it my imperative duty to urge in the strongest terms afforded by our language that this order may be rescinded. Then came the impassioned words to which the rest had served as prologue. "Here, directly in front of this army, is the heart of the rebellion. It is here that all our resources should be collected to strike the blow which will determine the fate of the nation. It matters not what partial reverses we may meet with elsewhere. Here is the true defense of Washington. It is here on the banks of the James that the fate of the Union should be decided." Halleck replied by wire and by mail. "I must take things as I find them," he said in the letter. "I find the forces divided, and I wish to unite them. Only one feasible plan has been presented for doing this. If you or anyone else had presented a better plan, I certainly should have adopted it. But all of your plans require reinforcements, which it is impossible to give you. It is very easy to ask for reinforcements, but it is not so easy to give them when you have no disposable troops at your command." The telegram, being briefer, was more to the point. After saying, "You cannot regret the order of withdrawal more than I did the necessity of giving it," Halleck put an end to the discussion. "It will not be rescinded, and you will be expected to execute it with all possible promptness." Next day, August 7th, the date of Lee's letter urging Jackson to consider a strike at Pope, the need for haste was emphasized in a second wire received by the harassed commander at Harrison's Landing. "I must beg of you, General, to hurry along this movement," Halleck told him. "Your reputation as well as mine may be involved in its rapid execution." Left with neither voice nor choice in the matter, McClellan worked hard to speed the evacuation. But he wrote his wife, "They are committing a fatal error in withdrawing me from here, and the future will show it. I think the result of their machination will be that Pope will be badly thrashed within 10 days, and that they will be very glad to turn over the redemption of their affairs to me." The danger, the crying need for haste, as Halleck saw it, was that Lee might take advantage of his interior lines and attack one or the other of the two main federal forces before the northward shift began, or worse still, while the movement was in progress. Of the two, Pope on the Rappahannock and McClellan on the James, Old Brains was most concerned about the former. As he put it to McClellan, who was struggling to extract his troops from the malarial peninsula bottoms, "This delay might not only be fatal to the health of your army, but in the meantime General Pope's forces would be exposed to the heavy blows of the enemy, without the slightest hope of assistance from you." Pope was worried too, although he did not let it show in his manner. Privately, he was complaining to Halleck about the supineness of the Army of the Potomac, which, he said, renders it easy for the enemy to reinforce Jackson heavily. And he urged, "Please make McClellan do something." Publicly, however, he showed no symptoms of doubt or trepidation. On August 8th, when he transferred his headquarters southward to Culpeper, Halleck wired him uneasily, "Do not advance so as to expose yourself to any disaster, unless you can better your line of defense until we can get more troops upon the Rappahannock. You must be very cautious." Pope seemed unalarmed. He appeared, in fact, not to have a single cautious bone in his whole body. He intended to hold where he was, despite the risk involved in the knowledge that Stonewall Jackson was before him, with a force he estimated at 30,000 men. Numerically, as of early August, his confidence was well-founded. Exclusive of Burnside, whose 12,000 had debarked at Aquia and were now at Falmouth, he had 77,779 soldiers in the Army of Virginia. Even after deducting the troops in the Washington fortifications, along with those in the Shenandoah Valley and beyond, he was left with just over 56,000 in the 8 divisions of infantry and 2 brigades of cavalry, comprising the 3 corps under McDowell, Banks, and Sigel. This was the field force proper, and it seemed ample for the execution of the project he had conceived at the outset. His intention had been to operate southward down the Orange and Alexandria to Gordonsville and beyond, thereby menacing the Virginia Central so that Lee would weaken the Richmond defenses to the point where McClellan could make a successful assault. McClellan's pending withdrawal would alter at least a part of this, of course, but Pope still thought the plan a good one, not the least of its advantages being that it had the approval and support of the administration, since it simultaneously covered Washington. What was more, his assignment, formerly minor or anyhow secondary, now became major. Instead of setting Richmond up for capture by McClellan, he would take the place himself, and be known thereafter as the man who broke the back of the rebellion. That was a thought to warm the heart. He would consolidate his gains, then proceed with his advance, reinforced by such numbers as reached him from the Army of the Potomac. At present, it was true, his striking force was rather scattered. More than a third of McDowell's corps, 11,000 infantry, with 30 guns and about 500 cavalry, was still at Fredericksburg, under Brigadier General Rufus King, blocking the direct approach to Washington. Now that Burnside had arrived, Pope might have summoned King to join him, but just now he preferred to keep him where he was, menacing Jackson's supply line and playing on Lee's fears for the safety of his capital. Besides, he felt strong enough without him. Banks and Sigel had come eastward through the passes of the Blue Ridge, and though their 5 divisions had not been consolidated either with each other or with McDowell's 2, Pope still had better than 44,000 troops with which to oppose the estimated 30,000 rebels in his immediate front. The situation was not without its dangers. Halleck kept saying so, at any rate, and old General Wool, transferred from Fort Monroe to Maryland, had warned him at the outset, "Jackson is an enterprising officer. Delays are dangerous." But Pope was not alarmed. If the highly touted Stonewall wanted a fight, at those odds, he would gladly accommodate him. Banks felt the same way about it, only more so, for while Pope intended to earn a reputation here in the East, Banks was determined to retrieve one. On August 8th, therefore, he was pleased to receive at Culpeper an order directing him to march his 2 divisions south. Jackson had crossed the Rapidan, moving north, and Pope wanted Banks to delay him while the rest of the army was being assembled to give him the battle he seemed to be seeking. Banks did not hesitate. McDowell and Sigel were behind him. King was on the way from Fredericksburg. Next morning, 8 hot and dusty miles out of Culpeper, he came under long-range artillery fire from the slopes of a lone peak called Cedar Mountain, and pressing on found rebel infantry disposed in strength about its northern base and in the woods and fields off to the right. After more than 2 months of brooding over the shocks of May, he was face to face with the old valley adversary whose soldiers had added insult to injury by giving him the nickname Commissary Banks. He was itching to attack then and there, but in the face of the known odds, he was down to about 8,000 men as a result of multiple detachments, while Jackson was reported to have at least 3 times that many. He did not feel free to do so on his own responsibility. Then a courier arrived from Culpeper, a staff colonel sent by Pope with a verbal message which seemed to authorize an immediate all-out attack. The officer's name was Lewis Marshall, a Union loyal Virginian and a nephew of R.E. Lee, who had said of him, "I could forgive his fighting against us, but not his joining Pope." Welcome as the message was, Banks could scarcely believe his ears. In fact, he had it written down and then read back for verification. "General Banks will move to the front immediately, assume command of all the forces in the front, deploy his skirmishers if the enemy approaches, and attack him immediately as soon as he approaches, and be reinforced from here. This ambiguous farrago, dictated by Lee's nephew in the name of Pope, was open to conflicting interpretations. It might mean that the attack was to be made with skirmishers only, holding the main body on the defensive until McDowell arrived to even the odds, and Siegel came up to stretch them in favor of the Union. On the other hand, it might mean what it said in the words that were quickest to catch the eye. Attack him immediately as soon as he approaches. That sounded like the army commander who 3 weeks ago had admonished his generals to seek the adversary and to beat him when he was found. At any rate, whatever the odds, Banks took him at his word. He put his men in attack formation and sent them forward on the left and on the right. Lee's letter of August 7th, recommending a swipe at Pope, had not been needed. For while he was writing it, Jackson was already putting his 25,000 soldiers in motion to carry out the strategy it suggested. His cavalry, having reported the superior enemy forces badly scattered beyond the Rapidan, he hoped to make a rapid march across that stream, pounce on one of the isolated segments, and withdraw valley-style before Pope could concentrate against him. So far, it did not work at all that way, however, primarily because another letter of Lee's, while needed, had not been heeded. A.P. Hill was kept as much in the dark as to his chief's intentions as Winder and Ewell had ever been. "I pledge you my word, Doctor.